Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Hospitals and clinics in South Dakota have been under incredible pressure during the COVID pandemic as thousands of South Dakotans have contracted the contagion. But the field hospitals we prepared for in March have not been needed so far, and hospital capacity, though strained, has overall held strong. So how are thousands of people getting the care they need? For today's Innovation Hour, we look at how South Dakota healthcare providers pivoted for a pandemic. We'll talk about how they were poised to respond, how they quickly adjusted to the emerging science of COVID care, and what they've learned about the healthcare delivery of the future. We begin the hour with Sanford Health's outpatient COVID infusion clinics. Earlier this week, we welcomed Amy Teasy, Sanford's Vice President of Nursing and Clinical Services for the Sioux Falls Network. I asked her to tell us about how these infusion clinics got started.
You know, when COVID started in early March and we continued to see patients come into our healthcare settings, we, as an organization, always kept our eye on what are those new and innovative therapies that were coming out of the research realm. And in mid to early November, these monoclonal antibodies therapy treatments that we would call our BAM product as well as Regeneron came out under an emergency utilization authorization. And again, as an organization, quickly looked at how we can provide these therapies not only in our larger metropolitan centers but in our rural locations as well. So it actually occurred quite rapidly over a matter of a couple of weeks of having these therapies become available and then getting those out into our rural locations. If you recall, back in November, we were seeing a significant spike in our inpatient COVID population as well as our county COVID populations or COVID positivity rate. So it was kind of a appropriate time to be able to bring these therapies to our outpatient population and provide a route to COVID care prior to admission in our hospitals.
Let's talk about the infrastructure for that. You are poised for that. Tell me how you made the pivot and where these clinics are at across the state of South Dakota, because I know you operate outside of the state, but let's talk about here at home.
Yes, here at home. So initially, when we first stood up these therapies, we did more of a centralized model through our research department, and established those locations in Sioux Falls, and then quickly again in our rural locations. So our Aberdeen, Chamberlain, Vermilion, Clear Lake, Canton. As well as we do work with our partners in our Brookings and Watertown locations as well. So it really took a team of operations and IT and infrastructure to make sure that we had all of the appropriate mechanisms in place that whether a patient called us or a provider identified a patient who had a positive COVID test that would be appropriate for the therapy, how they could access therapy, and how we would have a team ready to screen for appropriateness and get them into the treatment in the timeline to, again, reduce hospitalization and, again, also improve the recovery rates for these patients.
Let's talk about who qualifies for this. Who are the appropriate people? And clearly, this is a conversation that individuals would have with their doctors. But broadly speaking, you get that COVID-19 positive test, and then what?
Yeah, and fortunately, 80+% of patients that do have COVID-19 do not need these therapies and are able to recover at home. But however, there are several that have the mild to moderate disease, as well as maybe some high-risk conditions such as obesity or chronic kidney disease or diabetes that puts them at a higher risk for hospitalization or even severe progression to death. So again, identifying these patients early on within the symptomology of their COVID disease to get them in. Within those parameters, it is recommended that from 10 days of either onset of symptoms or from the positive test is when we would want them to come in and receive these therapies. So what we have found is beyond the 10 days really hasn't shown a significant improvement in their condition, as well as not only those comorbidities, but patients on oxygen are evaluated with some additional criteria to ensure that they are appropriate for these therapies.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's another reminder to people that if you feel like you've been exposed and you start feeling those symptoms, acting early is a good idea. Don't just go to bed if things are terrible, and don't make that phone call, because early matters. Am I getting that right?
You know, that is right. And again, the testing for COVID, centers around having positive symptoms or exposure. So you're right, getting to testing as it would be appropriate and identifying whether you do or do not have COVID. And then again, working with your provider at the local level as to what treatments are available to you and how we can get you the care that is appropriate.
Tell us a little bit about what happens. Pretend you're explaining it to a patient who says monoclonal what and infusion and what, and I already feel kind of crummy. Tell us a little bit more detailed information about the therapy itself.
Yeah, so as a patient would, again, either come to a COVID testing site to identify whether they are positive for COVID, or again, coming into their provider's clinic and identifying that they do have a positive test, we would walk through, again, what conditions might put you at a higher risk and whether you meet that criteria. And then when we bring them into our location, so again, in our rural hospitals, it is an outpatient infusion or an outpatient IV. You will receive the medication through an intravenous infusion in your arm. You will be there for an hour, and then we do ask our patients to stay an additional hour just to make sure that we monitor them for any side effects that might occur, and then they are free to go home and continue their rehabilitation. We do see an improvement in their symptoms, typically within 48 hours. We do, as an organization, also monitor globally some of the outcomes of the outpatient therapies, such as hospitalization rates or avoided hospitalization admissions that, again, certainly impact the lives of our community of patients.
What are you learning thus far? And I know it's early to look at the big picture of this, but as you monitor those outcomes, how has it been going?
You know, we have seen very, very good results from our patients. So some of it is anecdotal. So our patients come back and say how much better they feel. Their recovery maybe is a little more quickly, occurs more quickly when they've received these therapies. We do have some preliminary information to indicate that as an organization, we have been able to reduce hospital admissions over the course of time of these therapies. As an organization, we have administered 1,252 of these therapies across our Sanford footprint. But in our rural locations, we do approximately about 56 a week. So we do see that our physicians and our communities continue to see the benefits of these therapies.
The supplies holding steady? Are you able to get what you need from a nationwide supply chain perspective?
Yeah, I think, as we went through the summer and really had a shortage of what we call PPE or personal protective equipment, we have seen an increase in that supply. We do continue to monitor our supplies. We continue to evaluate whether we may have another surge of inpatients and, again, positivity rate in our communities. But we also rely on those manufacturers who have been able to improve their their inventories that then help us do the work that we need to do within our hospital as well as our clinic settings. So supplies have become a bit better, but always something on our radar.
Yeah. Are people receiving this treatment in the hospital as well? And are there, you know, two different groups of people, some that would receive this while they were hospitalized and some that would receive it on an outpatient therapy basis?
Yeah, these particular therapies are on an outpatient basis, so you would not be hospitalized. The goal is, again, that you have mild to moderate disease, not needing a hospital admission, so you're early enough in the disease that we can kind of stop the progression and keep you in your home. There is another set of therapies that would be for an hospitalized patients, and those would be Regeneron as well as some additional therapies such as steroids and those types of things that would be provided if you were actually hospitalized with COVID-19.
And one does not preclude the other, does it? In other words, if you get the outpatient therapy and then you end up needing hospitalization care anyway, you're not barred from any other treatment, are you?
That is an individual decision with the patient and the provider. So there are instances where you could receive both, and there may be instances where again, you would make a decision with your physician on what is the best course for you.
Next up, Avera Health, a system that also operates across the state and beyond in rural and urban areas. Avera has answered the increased need for at-home care in a variety of ways, from telehealth to 24-hour hotlines to reduce hospitalizations due to COVID-19. We spoke with Rhonda Wearing. She's VP of Clinical Growth and Innovation for Avera at Home. I started by asking her about how Avera was, in many ways, poised to meet the needs of COVID-19 patients.
We were really positioned well in order to take on this new program because we were providing care at home for patients across an 87-county footprint of the Avera Health System. And that included home health and hospice services, home medical equipment. We had built a very nice structure that really lended itself very well to be able to be very quickly able to adjust and create this Avera Care at Home COVID program. And so what occurred was in the early part of the COVID incidents back in late March, our physician leader teams at the hotline approached us and said, here's the problem we need help solving. We know that many patients who get COVID are going to be mildly ill and can be taught how to monitor their symptoms and be able to do just fine at home without the services. But we also believe we're going to have a fairly big population of patients that is at least moderately ill or has high comorbidities such as diabetes or heart disease or other diagnoses and that are likely to get more ill. And this is the population we need your help with. And what could we do together? And that's how the program got started.
So we were originally talking, you know, back in March of 2020 about field hospitals and things like that. We've always been watching those, you know, hospital capacity numbers and how many people are in ICU beds. Meanwhile, all this at-home care is also happening. Give me an idea of just how expansive this program became as you adjusted and, you know, how quickly that adjustment was made.
Right. Well, I'm really happy to say that we were able to make that adjustment within about 10 days. So beginning April 1st, we launched this new program and the structure of how it works is it begins with a physician visit, a virtual visit or physician visit, recognizing that they meet the criteria for the program. They order our services, and then a patient care coordinator contacts the patient within an hour to 2 hours at the longest to assess what patients need. So do they need oxygen? Everybody gets an oximeter, and then everybody's going to get set up with a nurse that's going to follow them every day. That's kind of the gist of the program. So that very mm-hmm. simple format is what we use for the program, and we still do today. So patients, once they're identified for the program, they receive this daily type of nurse intervention. We work very closely on a daily basis with internal medicine physicians to get the patients different medicines or different equipment, and also to get them to the hospital if they need to go during their illness. And we've been successful. As of this morning, we've cared for about 5,000 patients using this model of care.
So one of the things that people want to know is the outcome, because certainly you don't want people being treated at home and then not making it to the hospital soon enough, or having poor outcomes because they didn't get the care that they needed in a hospital setting. Tell us, on the other hand, it seems very logical. I would much rather be at home than hospitalized because of the comforts of home and the anxieties and stress of that, separation issues. Tell us a little bit about what you were learning about outcomes and what you now know that you didn't know about how this would work.
Right. Our outcomes have been very favorable. We've had no mortalities, so no deaths. We've been successful in getting patients to the hospital when they needed to go. Our overall outcomes in terms of percentages, we've had just under 5% of our patients have had to go to the hospital. Most of those patients we've been able to work with their physicians and keep and allow them to be at home yet. We've had about 7% of our patients that have had to go to the emergency room during the course of our care, and that really is to get a treatment adjustment. So those are pretty low numbers considering the severity of illness of patients that we're taking care of. From a patient satisfaction perspective, that's where this program really mattered. We've had over 97% patient satisfaction, talking about the importance and how we've been able to help people's anxiety. So it's very comforting to have that same nurse checking on the patient every single day, getting them through the times where they're feeling more short of breath, getting them the equipment that they need. That's been like the key, that thing that we've learned is that that daily contact, trusting a clinician who's become an expert in COVID care, so we really know what to expect. The other thing I would emphasize is that our team truly became experts in COVID care. So we became very adept at recognizing when patients were exhibiting symptoms that would lead them to need to go to the hospital, and we were able to get them there quickly. Patients, the 24/7 process that we use to get patients to the ER, it works. And that is one of, I think, the biggest successes. It makes a difference, and patients are telling us it makes a difference.
Yeah. This pandemic is, of course, far from over. I don't want to imply that, but I do want to ask the question of what have you learned that you think could be applied post-pandemic to other kinds of healthcare, emergencies, whether it's, people with asthma or people with diabetes or other kind of care. Are there applications for the future once once we have COVID a little further in our rearview mirror?
We learned a lot, definitely. I think one of the things that I really see what we did that made a difference is we were true partners with our physician leadership team in this effort. And that remains to be very critical. And I think any program that we would develop where we're providing more intensive types of care, either hospital level or more chronic disease level of care, we're going to want to continue that. So that because that relationship and that structure that we created allowed us to be very agile. So as soon as medical practice changes came down, evidence-based practices, we were very quickly able to implement them. So when the Centers for Disease Control recommended different oxygen requirements, we were very ready and agile enough that we could get the guidance from the physicians and then go ahead and implement it in the field. I think that's one of the biggest things. The other thing that we learned a lot about is the importance of data. So we were very fortunate to have a very robust electronic medical record and very talented report writers. so that we could see on live maps where patients were located. We were able to monitor patients who were having oximetry or oxygen levels that were falling, and that allowed us to get care to them quickly and get them escalated if they're having a problem.
Yeah. Well, Rhonda, before I let you go, the last time we talked, you and I talked about, taking care of yourself, getting sleep and watching your diet and just general immune boosting things as we all wash our hands and, continue the mitigation efforts that we really haven't let up. Do you know anything more about that now that you've, had so much experience with people who have fallen ill? Are there ways that we can prepare ourselves to not only stay healthy, but to get to recover more quickly based on patient behavior?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because what we talked about the last time I was on this show was the importance of taking really good care of yourself. I don't think much of that has changed. It's a little bit, I think one of the things that we as a population and healthcare experts need to continue to remind people about is we still have a COVID pandemic, and we're going to have to continue to use the self-care measures that we've been taking, we've been doing all along, and that the importance of wearing a mask and good hand hygiene and taking the very best care of yourself, both physically and emotionally, I think the new thing is let's get vaccinated. So we believe that that's going to really help our population get to a place that we need it to, so that we have got, we're able to prevent the ongoing surge of COVID in the nation.
We did speak with Rhonda Wearing yesterday, January 21st. Those numbers are from yesterday. We will continue this conversation today about innovation in COVID care across the state. Up next, we head to Pierre and later in the hour to Wagner, South Dakota. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour about innovations in COVID care here at home. Healthcare workers since SARS-CoV-2 was first detected in the U.S. have been operating in a kind of accelerated reality. They've been forced to use new ways to mitigate the worst impact of the pandemic. Some of that innovation will define healthcare in 2021 and into the future. Some of those days will define the lives of healthcare workers for years to come. Next, we welcome Dr. Philip Meyer. He's a hospitalist with the Vera St. Mary's Hospital in Pierre, South Dakota. Dr. Meyer, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to start with something we haven't talked about yet this hour, and it is not a side note by any means, but it is the actions of a staff, because as I keep asking people what kind of innovations they created or launched or were poised to take advantage of, I hear again and again about how people came together and did the hard work from an administrative standpoint, but also from a day-to-day working extremely long shifts under incredibly difficult circumstances. Tell me a little bit about some of the healthcare providers and administrators that you worked with so far during the pandemic and how they have responded to these enormous challenges.
You know, that's a great question, because it really is the majority of our story. And that is how people from every department across the health system have come together to make this happen. Dating back to March into April, we pulled together a committee of members that represented pharmacy, respiratory therapy, nursing, administration, the physicians, down to housekeeping and laundry and the food department, all really came together for a multidisciplinary task force meeting every Thursday morning that we put together. And really what it was a collision of people who all had to change the way they do everything, from the way we take people into the front desk to the way we get them to a room to where are we going to put these COVID patients to keep them away from everyone else. It's just an enormous task. And the pandemic and the unique nature of a COVID patient changed everyone's job. And what I'm most proud of in our facility is has been our ability to come together across those disciplines and make it work. We needed 2 to 3 times more personnel than we normally do, and we had upwards of 3 times more patients than we typically average in this building. And, you know, we had dermatologists coming over from clinic helping clean. We had CEOs and the CMOs of our organization passing food trays. Really, everybody chipped in and did their part.
When we talk about caring for people outside the hospital or in long-term care facilities or just trying to keep those numbers, you know, that hospital capacity, so many of us are looking at it as a number on a chart. For you, it's a very real thing. Tell me a little bit about how some of that was managed.
Well, you know, we are a hospital in South Dakota terms. We're a mid-sized hospital, okay? So we are licensed for 60 beds, but no one has seen 60 patients in this hospital since the 1970s, okay? That's just medicine has shifted to outpatient. And so everywhere across the globe, across the country, you'll see hospitals that are licensed for X beds but don't typically use them and therefore don't have the staff to man those beds. And so this is a hospital that typically sees 15 to 16 inpatients per day. And in order to take care of triple, quadruple that, we had to double rooms. You know, we have a 6-person ICU and peer that held 9 patients at one time during the pandemic. We had every one of our ventilators in use for a few days, off and on throughout the pandemic. And we had 2 ventilated patients in some rooms in the ICU, which is something we've never done. We brought in nurses and care technicians from the clinics to come over here and help us out, and they all signed up on the roster and worked long shifts, night shifts, split shifts to make it happen. And really what it amounts to is we just had to work completely outside of our usual box. And we still are to some degree, but for the most part, our volume is far less than it was during
Say November or December when some of this
November, December for sure.
We're not out of this pandemic. Vaccines are rolling out, but there are people who will die from COVID-19 waiting for a vaccination. What do you want to say about the importance of, you know, seeing what you have seen when things have been at their worst? You don't want to go back to that worst or even a more dramatic impact. What do you want to tell people about continuing mitigation and the work that all of us need to do to continue to fight this virus?
You know, first and foremost, in this age of vaccination, please, I would recommend everybody get it. You know, it's going to have, some people are going to have some mild side effects like muscle aches and headaches that last one day. Believe me, those are side effects that you should be willing to accept as getting COVID is far worse. We've seen, you know, unbelievable suffering caused by this infection. Can't imagine why anyone wouldn't want to get the vaccine. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of negative coverage, a lot of mythical things created about the virus about the vaccine that simply are not true. And, you know, maybe the one thing I really want to emphasize to people is that too often we talk about and the press talks about and we're focused on how many people are getting the disease and how many people are dying. But there isn't a lot of discussion about what happens to the people who are sick enough to get admitted to the hospital and they make it. And they don't become one of the statistics other than they were a positive test. And some of those people are in the hospital for 3 days, but there are some who are in the hospital for 30. I discharged a patient from the hospital today with COVID-19 who was here for 30 days. And there isn't a lot of discussion about the suffering that those people feel, the pain, the muscle aches, the shortness of breath, the complications from lying in bed, the weakness that happens from lying in bed. And, you know, It isn't just about getting the disease and maybe or maybe not dying from it. There's a lot of morbidity attached to it, a lot of time, a lot of disability, something you don't want. I just greatly emphasize that getting the vaccine and whatever mild side effects it may have pale in comparison to the true illness.
In her State of the State address, Governor Kristi Noem talked about the success story of treatment in Pierre and how healthcare providers work together. She mentioned the long-term care facility there and how many residents fell ill and how they responded to that because of the possibility of overwhelming the hospital in Pierre if all those residents needed hospital care. What can you tell us about that partnership and how that situation unfolded?
Yes, that nursing home, I think by the time it was over, all but a couple of their residents contracted COVID-19. We did hospitalize a number of them, but the majority of them were kept in place, managed with oxygen through essentially a stay-in-place program that worked very, very well. It's one example of many that prevented us from having, say, 100 to 150 patients in this hospital. You know, at maximum, we reached around 40. And early in the planning stages, we were planning for 150. And I think it weren't for the stay-at-home programs, we would have had 100 patients in this hospital. So, you know, historically, if a person's low on oxygen, that is a definite trigger for hospitalization. And during the pandemic, we've had to change that approach. We've had to shift to one of treating people at home. For years, there's been discussion about hospital care at home, and it just hasn't come of prime time. During the pandemic, we've had an opportunity to test it out of necessity. And so Avera, for instance, has put together a really aggressive hospital at home program for the pandemic, literally upwards of 1,200 people at a time during the peak were being treated at home with home nurses on oxygen. That's around the Avera region. I know we had many people in central South Dakota being treated at home through this aggressive program that really worked well. And of course, some people weren't able to stay at home and did end up in the hospital. But if we were to have to hospitalize every one of them, there's no way we could have performed it. I mean, we would not have had enough resources or personnel to manage it here. So a very big success story.
We talked with Rhonda Wearing of Avera about some of those numbers and those outcomes, and you know, she quoted a 97% satisfaction from patients as well. From an anecdotal standpoint, as you dealt with some of those patients and listened to some of the providers in the Pierre area about those at-home and hospital-at-home programs, what were you hearing about what was working? Because I can imagine there was some uncertainty because through necessity, you had to do things that you weren't sure what those outcomes would be. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think it took everybody to a place they had never really been before. Certainly, home health care is not new to us, but home health care for the acutely ill patient in an effort to keep them out of the hospital is definitely new to us. And so everyone from the family medicine doctors to the patients and their families were a little bit skittish about this, for lack of a better word. It's scary to be ill enough to warrant a hospital, yet encouraged to stay home. But as the days went by, the weeks went by, it became pretty apparent to all involved that, hey, this can work. A lot of people with COVID-19 get sick enough to require oxygen, and with intensive guidance here and intensive management at home, we can manage their fevers and so forth at home. And so, you know, video conferencing, phone calls between, you know, patients and their physicians became a reality. And a lot of the things surrounding that were waived during the pandemic so that physicians could perform remotely.
What kept you up at night in the worst days of the pandemic in November, December, when we were watching, you know, so many people fall ill and die in the state? You're dealing with the details of all those care and maybe don't have time to think about it like others do. What were the things that kept driving you forward?
You know, step-by-step success, day by day, small encouraging improvements in our patients. We had plenty who didn't improve, but it was those who looked like they were going to make it out the door that kept you coming back and kept you motivated to do what you were doing. Never knowing how many patients were coming in or how many were going to flood the emergency room, it did cause has caused some angst. Knowing that I had a fantastic team surrounding me, from nurses to lab to respiratory therapy to radiology, is really what kept us motivated and knew that we could do this.
Yeah. What can you tell us about vaccination distribution in the peer area and how that is going? We've got a lot of questions coming in about how people are going to get vaccinated.
You know, we've been able to successfully administer the vaccines we've been allowed. And I think everyone wishes that we could get more. That being said, I think as a whole, South Dakota is doing well in terms of distributing vaccine. But we've got nurses who have come out of semi-retirement and part-time jobs elsewhere who have volunteered to give shots. We've got plenty of people doing it. We have a really good throughput in the system we have. People are getting their vaccines on time and showing up for the time they've signed up for. We are doing what we need to do with the number of vaccines we're given. And I think given more vaccine, we could do it. We could also respond to the challenge, no question.
Does that come from the federal level, the state level? Is it that those vaccines are going elsewhere in the state? How do you get more?
You know, that's a good question. I know that the vaccines, by definition, belong to the Department of Health, and they're distributed by the federal government, and the Department of Health dictates where they go. I think all of that has been prorated based on population. I suppose there isn't a community in the state that doesn't feel like they wish they had more vaccine to administer, because I'm sure everyone's phone lines are blowing up. And so I'm not sure that there is a way, unless the DOH gets more from the federal level, there probably isn't a way to get us more on the community level.
Yeah. Dr. Philip Meyer, thank you so much for joining us today and for all the work that you and the hundreds of people around you have been doing for the past year and will continue doing in the days ahead. Come back anytime and give us an update.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest. All right. You have a good day.
We'll take a break. More on innovation in COVID care. We head to Wagner next. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour about innovations in COVID care. In Governor Kristi Noem's State of the State Address, she lauded the innovations in South Dakota communities such as Wagner. Today, we welcome Brian Slava, Chief Executive Officer of Wagner Community Memorial Hospital. Brian Slava, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So this is such a fascinating story because clearly the pandemic is not over and we're still very much in the thick of things, but we are hearing more of these stories about how people have innovated and pivoted. Tell us a little bit about your experiences in Wagner.
Well, Wagner was one of the very first communities that had a COVID-19 positive report back in March of 2020, obviously. And since then, we have really focused in on making sure that our most vulnerable population were protected the best we could. The nice part was is that, especially in our long-term care, they were able to keep it at bay up until just recently in December. The timing of some of the therapeutics that were coming out, such as BAM is what we call it, were on time to where the hospital here could start bringing that in and administering it. And it, that's where we're innovative in the fact that not only did we bring that in with the help of the federal government and Avera Health Systems, but also the fact that Wagner Good Sam was allowing us to administer some of this over at their facility after we were able to confirm it with the state that we'd be in compliance. And we were able to get some of these therapeutics into the individuals, thus saving lives in the long run. So, you know, there's innovation along this entire line in the fact that you go from we have no idea what we were up against when this thing first started, and so you just give yourself enough flexibility to figure out which way you've got to go when it comes down to doing one thing and one thing only, taking care of the patient, taking care of your community.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your staff and the ways that they have endured just the long hours and the uncertainty and the stress and the wearing of personal protective equipment, you know, beyond what they imagined they would have to when they first got into medicine.
You mentioned every part of it. When we first got into this, we knew that, again, Wagner had one of the first cases, so it really elevated our concern. We immediately took a look at our PPE inventory. Knowing that it was going to be tough to get by, we pulled out what they call PAPRs. They're like a half hazmat suit with a air filtration device on them that it has a HEPA filter so that you're always bringing in clean air into a hooded type area. We also at the same time had four portable negative air pressure rooms that have air scrubbers on them that we were able to hook on to the outside of our hospital room doors to where we could start pulling the air out, cleansing it, so that our people would go in there then in the hazmat suits or in these PAPRs. But the situation you've got is that every time you went in and out, you had to wipe that PAPR down, you pulled it off, it's uncomfortable, it's cumbersome. But at the same time, it was the greatest level of protection that we could have. So was there definitely, after a few months of this and all the anxiety on just how infectious and how it was being transmitted, yes, there was a lot of anxiety behind this. And so we took extreme care to make sure that we were taking the proper PPE, we were doing all the sanitizing necessary, we started figuring out how we were going to use N95s, trying to save as much of our disposable PPE as possible, and using these reusable PAPRs. But that takes a toll on them. I mean, we called it after a few months. There was COVID fatigue out there because of this masking and the PAPRs and everything else. And so then when you're working on them and then you're working on some very complex patients, every time you went through that, it just wore you down and kept wearing you down. But the team around here formulated a way to rotate through, making sure that they were covering each other, make sure they had everybody's back. We made sure that not one person was always taking on the same responsibilities and going into this, the COVID wing or the COVID rooms that we've got, into these portable tents and stuff that we had set up for our rooms. We just made sure that our staff were taken care of the best we could so that at least it reduced the anxiety of them contracting this disease, thus allowing them to take better care of our patients.
What did you learn about outcomes for some of this care and this COVID-19 therapy that you were treating with residents in the nursing home or on an outpatient basis? So much of it was unknown. What have you learned about how effective some of those treatments are turning out to be? Still, again, science still emerging on this.
Yeah. When we first heard it was coming out, I was sort of on the lookout for it after President Trump at that time had said that he had gotten the Regeneron and that it had helped him. Well, eventually when BAM, which is a very similar pharmaceutical, was brought to our ability to grab it and was brought to the state, I had my physician and my vice president for patient care services review it, saying, guys, I think this could be real helpful, but I want to make sure that it is still safe. We looked at it. My physician said, yeah, we've been using this type of treatment for a long time, maybe not just specifically in this area, but it might be worth a chance. And that physician, Dr. Michaela Koenig, is also the medical director at the local Good Sam, and we knew that it had not breached the walls of the local Good Sam, and therefore we wanted to make sure we had every opportunity to help take care of patients when they were, if and when it ever breached those walls. Well, in the meantime, it was breached. And all I can speak to is the anecdotal information that we've got here. 2 days ago, we gave our 100th dose of BAM. our 100th dose. We are a town of 1,600, and we gave 100. We've given 100 doses. 98 of them have recovered. 31 of those doses were given to long-term care facility patients, of which half of them, we actually trudged through some snow to go over there with our IV poles in hand to administer it over in their place, to where dementia patients and non-ambulatory patients and patients that were just confused or, you know, that weren't able to travel or would be more comfortable over there, we actually delivered it over there. Now think about this, 31 over there, another 69 elsewhere, and we've had 98 recovered. Anytime this stuff is entered, anytime COVID-19, which is a very devastating disease, especially for our most vulnerable population, has entered a facility like that, the anticipation is anywhere from 33 to upwards of 50% mortality. And yet we have two that succumbed to it, and there's other extenuating circumstances behind both of them. And not a single patient that has gotten BAM outside of that in the outpatient treatment has since passed away because of it. This product, in our opinion, what we're looking at is absolutely amazing. Now, how I can't afford to do a double-blind study around here, and I can't afford to wait until the studies are back or all the information is back. We had to sort of take a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And that leap of faith, in my opinion, has truly paid off, because if we'd have had the same mortality rate over at the long-term Good Sam over there, they would have had 14 to 18 deaths. Instead, we're running at two right now, and we haven't seen any additional positive COVIDs over in the Good Sam over there in now, I want to say, 3 weeks.
In our remaining minute here or so, I want to ask you about the vaccine and how that distribution is going in Wagner, because that's the next big push. What can you tell me about that in about 60 seconds here?
Okay. It's going very well, very well. The state, through Avera, and us through Avera, we are the hub down here. We vaccinated 165 already. Those are 1A and 1C individuals. We just received word to start preparing for the 1D tier 1 people. That is the over 80 and those that have are on dialysis, active cancer, or a transplant, post-transplant. And we are setting up our first pods for those over the next week. The hope is that we will start inoculating that demographic as soon as February 1, but we're still looking at that. It's all dependent on vaccine coming in and the allocation that the federal governments have given to the state, which is based on infection rate and state size. And so once that comes in, they're going to allocate it back down to us, deliver it to us. And we have been given that once we receive the vaccine, it's in somebody's arm within 24 to 48 hours.
So distribution,
so right now,
you're feeling confident about, it's a supply, that you're ready to take more, is what I'm hearing you say there.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yes.
We could take 10 times more than what we've got right now and inoculate everybody that is on that list. We've got our system set up. We know what we're doing. We know how we're recording it. Our staff is doing a great job of making sure that we're running everything on time, but it's still a limited number of vaccines coming through, and that's based on manufacturing and their supply chains, which, from my understanding, are holding it up a little bit. But maybe this Johnson & Johnson one that they're going to try to get taken for their EAU on January 29th may start helping some of that supply.
CEO Brian Slaba, thank you so much from the Wagner Community Memorial Hospital. We appreciate your time. You're welcome back anytime as we continue to tell this story. Thanks so much.
Thank you.